From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. We're going to hear now about steel, or more precisely, about the legacy of steel here in the U.S. Gary, Indiana, once a thriving steel town, is still a steel town, but it's hardly thriving, and we'll hear more on Gary in a moment. First, to Pittsburgh, the place that some still call the Steel City, has reinvented itself. Its unemployment rate is nearly 2% better than the national average. Plus, it's home to 1,600 technology companies and a growing population. Dan Bobkoff of the Midwest Public Radio Collaborative Changing Gears walks us through just how Pittsburgh transformed itself.
The first thing you should know about Pittsburgh is it's serious about its football.
Anybody selling tickets?
Cleveland sucks!
On game days, it's like the whole city piles into parking lots near Heinz Field. Fans wear the Steelers logo, still based on the mark of the steel industry. But you don't hear much about steel when you talk to tailgaters.
All of our jobs are on the rise.
Yes, Pittsburgh's economy is booming.
Pittsburgh is probably one of the most livable cities around.
Meds and eds. That's the new manufacturer. Medicine and education.
That's Melissa Zabella, Kevin Clark, Dawn Bourne, and Anthony Neff. Pittsburgh has come a long way from the early post-war years, when it produced half the country's steel and a lot of its soot. Joel Tarr teaches at Carnegie Mellon University.
It was so bad that you had to have the streetlights turned on at noon in downtown Pittsburgh a number of days during the winter and the fall.
That was no way to live, and the city's future was as murky as the pollution gripping it. But in this period, a surprising coalition formed to clean things up. Leaders from business, universities, nonprofits, and government joined together to create smoke controls and clean water rules. Even so, when Steve Lee came to Pittsburgh in the early 70s to go to Carnegie Mellon, steel production was still taking a toll.
And I'd come to school at the end of summer vacation, and for 2 weeks my eyes would run. I'd have a sore throat just from all the junk that was in the air.
Lee eventually became enamored with this steel town. Today, he's the head of that architecture department where he was once a student. And he remembers those late nights studying in the 70s when he'd look out his window.
The sky was just throbbing in red as the open hearth furnaces were being stoked. And this is an amazing place. But I was very young. I didn't realize we were at a moment of an huge transformation.
Now, U.S. Steel, for its part, says it will go ahead with plans to shut that mill on April the 1st. 790 people will lose their jobs.
By the early 80s, the steel era came to an abrupt end. This was not some long, drawn-out decline like the auto industry. Virtually overnight, 150,000 manufacturing jobs were wiped out. Many blamed deregulation and foreign competition.
The closing of the mill hits much more than just the 1,200 workers inside.
I never have ever badmouthed U.S. Steel. They paid me for every minute I worked.
Colin McNeely was one of those forced to reinvent himself.
I know a lot of people today take the position that, they weren't treated right. Well, suck it up and move on. That's what you have to do.
McNeely went to college and law school in his 40s. Education played a role in the city's reinvention, too. Carnegie Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh became powerhouses in computing, robotics, and biotechnology. Companies were spun off, and as Steve Lee shows me on a driving tour, these sectors started replacing steel.
There's Sunoco Aristech Research Facility.
A former mill on the river is now a bustling technology park. In recent years, that coalition of groups that helped clean up Pittsburgh in the 50s used those established relationships to make projects like this happen.
So the building site is fully occupied.
Of course, not everyone has benefited from Pittsburgh's turnaround. There are still poor neighborhoods and racial divisions. But it's a long way from the general despair of the 80s. Today, no one thing dominates Pittsburgh's economy. At a church turned into a brew pub, you now find people like Rob Meyer, who started a company that will text your cell phone when a table is ready at a restaurant. Meyer is from San Francisco, but stayed in Pittsburgh after attending Carnegie Mellon.
But I kind of started liking Pittsburgh. It has a small town feel, but it's kind of a big city, and I thought it was actually a really good place to start a technology business.
One quick announcement before we get started.
This transformation is still very new, as White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs learned as he announced Pittsburgh as the site of last year's G20 summit. It was a time to showcase the city's progress to the world, but he couldn't get any respect for the place.
In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Get a little murmur there.
But Pittsburgh residents aren't laughing. There's a strong proactive movement there. This is a city that doesn't wait for things to happen anymore. And that's why other cities trying to emerge from their industrial past now look to Pittsburgh with envy. For NPR News, I'm Dan Bobkoff.
Technology, you may complain, can make life more complicated. It can create information overload and stress, but some technology seeks to fix these problems. We called on Sri Srinivasan. He's a digital media professor at Columbia University. We asked him what websites and software he uses to bring order and efficiency to his life.
An example might be something like Evernote. Evernote is a service that helps you control and keep track of all the notes and reminders and things that you might make for yourself. And earlier, they might have been spread out all over your computer or on Post-its all over your desk. But now, using Evernote, which you can find at evernote.com, you can bring some order to the chaos that is your life. To me, one of the best products for making my life efficient has been Google Docs. And Google Docs allows you to create documents in the cloud, meaning off your computer rather than on a specific machine. I'm a big fan of being able to just log onto any computer in the world and make edits to my files.
What about something like gotomypc.com, which effectively, I think, takes your computer just about anywhere?
Right. It allows you to access your computer so that you're able to log into it using remote control software. There might be times when at home you don't have as good a computer as you do at work, or your office doesn't pay for specific software at home that they do at the office. And I know a lot of people who use it in that manner, so that you go home and you log on to one computer at work and you're able to manipulate files on it at home or anywhere on the road. So that way you're carrying maybe a lighter laptop when you're on the road, or when you're at home, it's not as sophisticated a machine.
Well, I mentioned information overload in the introduction. Mm-hmm. People are on Twitter, people are on Facebook, people might have a Gmail account. They're checking all these places. Anything you can recommend just to deal with that?
So a couple of things that I use. One is a site called Hootsuite.com, H-O-O-T Suite, S-U-I-T-E.com, which allows you to bring order to your social media chaos by bringing in your Facebook, your Twitter, your LinkedIn, and any other tools like that into one page so that you're able to look and, using the software, manage your social media presence.
I know you've written about a place, a site called Lifehacker.com, and then maybe just quickly, what is it?
The word hacking, I think, has changed in meaning over the last few years. Hacking used to always be about kind of bad guys trying to bring down computers and computer systems. I think hacking now also means you're trying to do something to improve something. It's a fix or a workaround. And lifehacker.com is a terrific site full of tips about making your life better. You will see all kinds of new software, all kinds of tips on using software better. A recent piece there was the top 10 ways in which you can improve your workspace to make your life and your work more efficient.
Sri Srinivasan is a professor of digital media at Columbia University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next this hour, we're going to...
Ira?
Annette Heist, our senior producer, has joined us. Well, you snuck right into the studio.
Sorry, I hate to interrupt, but there's a deadline approaching, and I think our listeners want to hear about it.
A deadline.
Some energy efficient tax credits are set to expire on December 31st this year. And I think this is some news you can use for our listeners.
Now, I know why you're interested in this, because of people who follow your blog. They watch you fixing your house out there in Pennsylvania, right?
Right.
And you're trying to find the most energy efficient way to recoup your dollars.
Yeah, that's right. I'm interested in trying to cut my electric bill. I've been at this project for a couple years. And I'll brag a little bit. I've since I started, I took 200 kilowatt hours off my monthly average bill.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And saved money doing that. And you have...
No, I didn't save money.
You didn't?
My electricity rates went up by almost the same amount. So my bill
is
even.
Boy, did they fool you. Well, so you're a little... So now you're looking for new ways, and you say if there are things that we should do before the end of the year.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Like what?
Well, if you have a couple extra dollars to spend, I would recommend a storm door.
You can, if you install a storm door between now and the end of the year, right. you can get back 30% of the cost of that storm door. And so if you, up to a certain amount, so if you pay, say, $300 for a storm door and you file the paperwork with your taxes, you can get back about $90.
Wow, that's pretty good money.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah, and so there, and what else? Give me something else.
Okay, so
if I don't want the storm door under my tree, what else can I do?
These credits are going to expire on December 31st. You can, if that's a little bit too much money to spend right. for you, you can pick up some insulation for your house, and that includes weather stripping, spray foam in a can. You can
good stocking stuffer.
Good stocking stuffer. Stuff your stocking with some insulation.
Well, I mean a can of spray, you know, that you put into the wall sockets or something that really
yes.
seal up the place.
If it's a product designed to make your home more energy efficient, to seal up, you know, drafts around
right.
the door, then yes, it qualifies for the tax credit.
So even if it's like a $10 item,
yes.
I can still get that, say, $3 or
yeah,
something.
If you're willing to, you know, keep your receipt and do the paperwork. So you can get 30% back up to $1,500. And that $1,500 is for 2009 and 2010 combined. Mm-hmm. So if you took the credit last year, you can't do it for 2010. And I should add also that that this has to be your primary residence for these credits. And if you share a house with somebody, it's $1,500 for the house. It's not
right.
per person.
Right,
so,
right. What else have you got on your list of things I could say?
Well, it might be a little late in the year for you to do this, but a new roof would qualify.
We're having a barn raising at my house between now and the end of the year.
And that includes metal roofs or asphalt roofs. Also heating systems, air source heat pumps, a propane furnace, and this is a doable one, a biomass stove. That's a stove that burns corn or wood pellets. And if you get that in your house and up and running by December 31st, you can get 30% back up to $1,500 for that. So basically, if you spend $5,000 on these improvements, you're going to maximize this tax credit. And I should add that some of these are going to be extended into next year in the bill that was just passed by Congress, mm-hmm. the new tax bill that was just passed, and the president is signing, I think, in 5 minutes. but it's my understanding that the new credits are not going to be as beneficial as these are. So act now. You want to get and these things have to be in place by December 31st.
So while you're not going to be popping that champagne, you're going to be caulking that window.
I'm going to multitask on New Year's Eve. I will have a glass of champagne in one hand and a caulk gun in the other.
Now, we hear about the credits for things like solar panels and stuff
right.
like that.
Those are still in place, and those don't expire until 2016. Now, that's for solar panels, geothermal heat pumps, small wind turbines, if you're thinking about putting one of those in your backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no upper limit on that. So that doesn't stop at $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a little bit more time to plan ahead for those.
Mm-hmm. And okay, what else? Now I've got the stocking stuffers. I've got the storm door under the tree. What else can I do?
Well, if you're looking to cut your electricity bill in a way that you don't even have to spend any money, you can unplug that second refrigerator that you might have in your basement.
It's got that one giant pizza in it that fits no other
right,
place.
Right, maybe a turkey in there. You had a turkey in there at Thanksgiving and
right.
a bottle of soda. Get rid of it, because according to everything I've read, that's one of a common thing that a lot of people have in their house, and it really just sucks energy up. And I did a little calculation. If you go to energystar.gov, which is a great website for figuring out how much it costs to run your dryer, or should you wash in cold water, or any appliance that you have in your house, you want to know how much it costs to run it, go to energystar.gov, and they have tons of information. They have one of my favorite things is the refrigerator retirement savings calculator. So it's actually a little refrigerator. You pick your model, whether you had side-by-side or the freezer on the top. You put in the year that you bought it, and it will tell you, you put in how much you pay for your mm-hmm. electricity per kilowatt hour,
right.
and it'll run a calculation and tell you how much it's costing you to keep that second refrigerator going in your basement. And here's what I calculated it for what I pay, $835 for 5 years, which
wow.
is about $167 a year to keep that refrigerator going. So almost a whole electric bill.
Wow, a whole month of, yeah, wow.
Then that's for an older refrigerator. Yeah. That was the one that I got rid of when I replaced my refrigerator recently, was about a 1990 refrigerator. So EnergyStar.gov says if your refrigerator is made before 1993, that it's probably a good idea to say goodbye.
If you got that old Crosley, remember those Crosley with the handle that opens up, or any old refrigerator, because they were so energy inefficient in those days.
Yes.
Just sitting there and running, I think it's probably one, along with the air conditioning system, which are not, they're not running here in the wintertime.
Right.
It's probably the single biggest user of electricity, right, in the house?
In your house right now, if you have electric heat, that's probably it, and also your water heater. Those are the things that really suck up the energy.
And if we replace our water heater, we get a credit for that?
If you replace it, you're testing me now. I think if you if it's a heat pump water heater, right, there are credits, but you might also qualify for some credits that vary by state, and you can find out if you can get that if there are credits in your state by going to the same website where they have a map. You click on your state, and it'll tell you what qualifies. And I have to say, for my state, Pennsylvania, they ran out of money.
Because so many people wanted to do this.
So many people wanted to do it. They have a waiting list now for rebates. But I did go to my electricity provider, and they also give rebates. And I found that you can get, for instance, $50 back on a refrigerator, $75 back on a clothes washer, $10 back on a dehumidifier. Mm-hmm. And a couple other things, a programmable thermostat, they'll give you $50 back if you install one of those. And those just have to be ENERGY STAR qualified.
Wow, and you can put that in yourself. And it pays for itself.
Right, that's about what they cost. I priced them at a couple of the big box stores, and they cost between $30 and $100, depending on how fancy, if you want it to be different on the weekends or just Monday through
Friday. So $50 is a wash.
Yeah.
It's a wash. Now, for folks who are still buying those Christmas tree lights,
yes,
can you save money there if you get the right kind of lights?
You can get LED lights now. And I was looking at those the other day, and they're about $12 for a string of 60. They use significantly less energy than the regular Christmas lights that we're used to, but they're expensive. You're putting out some money up front, but they do use a lot less. And I think another added bonus to those is that they burn not hot, so they're not a fire hazard. Mm-hmm.
Anything else that people can do to lower their bills?
Well, I brought you a present.
Oh, it's got a little. Actually, it's got a little.
Happy Hanukkah! Bone. Sorry, it's late.
It's a kilowatt
easy.
It's a electricity usage monitor. Oh, this is the thing you plug your appliance in.
Right, you plug that into the wall, the kilowatt, and then you plug your appliance into the kilowatt. You program in how much you pay for electricity, and it'll tell you how much it's costing you to run that thing, your laptop, your fan.
Because there's something draining all the time, even when it's off, right?
Well, you can check it.
Yeah.
You can check it with the kilowatt easy. Plug it into there and see how much. Is it really true that when you leave that cell phone charger in the wall that it's, you know, contributing a lot to your energy bill? You can do a test.
Well, thank you very much, Annette.
My pleasure.
I'm going to take this home and try it out tonight.
Okay.
Senior producer Annette Heist, you can follow her blog. She's out there saving energy for us all and learning how to do it. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
It's been nearly 8 months since the Deepwater Horizon tragedy killed 11 workers and spilled millions of gallons of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. Since April, federal agencies have launched a series of separate investigations. This week, the U.S. Chemical Safety Board held its first round of public hearings. NPR's Jeff Brady is here to help us sort through the various panels and their findings so far. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
How many investigations are there again?
If you count just sort of those big government investigations, then there are 5 of them underway right now. They're all separate from each other, but they're pretty much examining the same question of what happened and how can it be prevented in the future. I think most of us have heard of the highest profile investigation. That's the President's Spill Commission, mm-hmm. and their report is due out next month. There's a joint investigation by the Coast Guard and the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. They're going to have a report right around the one-year anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon accident. And the National Academy of Engineering, they put out an interim report here a couple of months back that talked about some of the signs that the crew on the Deepwater Horizon missed. They're going to have a final report out in June. And then you mentioned the Chemical Safety Board, very independent. They don't actually have a deadline, so we don't know when that report will come out. And then the Department of Justice, of course, is investigating to determine any sort of legal action that that agency might take.
There are so many investigations because you have various agencies that feel they have to essentially get on the boards with their own analysis, or does the multiplicity of investigations bring out more information and result in changes?
Each time one of these agencies saw what the others were doing and they thought, well, I can bring something more to this, they launched their own investigation. So now we're left with five different investigations. I think the interesting question right now is, when we get into next summer and a lot of these folks have released their final reports, are these investigations going to be reaching similar conclusions? Because if they're not, then we're going to have a whole new set of questions to answer here.
Let me follow up on DOJ, because they filed a civil lawsuit against BP and some of the other companies involved this week. What about the possibility of criminal charges?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there were criminal charges filed. The civil lawsuit that you just mentioned it's based on the government's belief that BP and the rig operator Transocean and the other companies involved took shortcuts on safety, and that led to the accident. In the filing here this last week, they said that the companies didn't use proper equipment in drilling that exploratory well. The crew didn't pay enough attention to the warning signs that were on the rig and down below underwater. And Attorney General Holder specifically said in announcing that civil suit that this was only the first step that his department was taking, that the criminal investigation is ongoing. And, of course, this administration has sent pretty strong messages all along that they're going to hold these companies accountable.
And, of course, you mentioned the President's Oil Spill Commission report coming out in a few weeks, but they've already kind of released a few findings, haven't they?
In October, there was a staff report specifically critical of Halliburton's cementing job. This past week, there was another staff report talking about these sand barriers that the local politicians wanted built to sort of stop that oil as it would come ashore to Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And the commission staff put out a working paper saying that those barriers were pretty much ineffective. And Governor Jindal actually called the assessment a partisan assessment. And that really gets to another issue with this President's Spill Commission, that folks within the oil industry really feel like they're not represented on that panel, that it's a heavily weighted in favor of environmentalists.
And has the tragedy that began the spill at the Deepwater Horizon brought about a substantial change in safety standards?
The regulators have pretty much rewritten their rules. They've completely overhauled their program. Huge changes have taken place over the last 8 months. That's really confused the industry. I think the real issue that we have here is that this is an industry that's used to having a pretty close relationship with its regulators. The previous administration, a lot of those folks came out of the oil industry. And while these folks feel like they're being specifically targeted, I think it's really more of an issue of them becoming accustomed to having a thorough and vigorous regulator once again.
NPR's Jeff Brady, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Net neutrality is not anonymity, especially if you're stupid enough to post everything about yourself online. Boasts of misdeeds on social media sites may stem from the desire to impress, but the consequences, as some are learning, go far beyond the circle of friends who follow you. On December 10th, Washington Post writer and editor Mark Fisher's home was burglarized. Fisher's new coat, still in the box, was missing, as were his son's iPod, savings bonds, cash, and a laptop. Mark Fisher is at the Washington Post. Mark, what happened next?
Well, we've not only discovered that we've been burglarized, but we discovered that on my son's Facebook news feed, on his wall, was a photograph of the burglar wearing my winter coat and holding my son's money with his finger pointed at the money and a big smirk on his face, like he'd just gotten away with something.
Everyone can see that picture, by the way, on NPR.org. You wrote that even though there's this incriminating evidence, there's no guarantee that the police would investigate the crime. I mean, why is that?
Well, you know, as the officers very frankly told us straight out, you know, this is a violation of personal space. People are terribly upset when they are burglarized, but burglary is a crime that falls to the very bottom of concerns for police. Of course, once we wrote about it in the Washington Post, that changed the whole dynamic, and obviously they moved more definitively than they might have for anyone else.
But in your column about the robbery, you did enumerate some recent arrests that actually were possible because of the suspect's social media ignorance. Well, what were some of them?
Well, there was a case in New York where very similarly a robber posted a photo of himself on his MySpace page with the watch that he'd stolen from someone on the street. The New York police are actually very aggressive and proactive about this. They actually scan the social media sites looking for evidence, even sometimes before they're called in on a case.
Well, here's the suspect creating, as one local television reporter said, his own wanted poster. What's your sense about Facebook and how the police can cooperate with Facebook and vice versa? What kind of information can they get?
Well, you know, the Facebook folks are in something of a bind. They have to go out and tell all of their consumers and members that they're going to protect your privacy. On the other hand, we all want them to cooperate with law enforcement when that's called for. So the Facebook people basically stand on a very legalistic kind of line where they say, if the police give us a subpoena for information, we will forward the kinds of information we can get. And if you go onto your account settings on Facebook, you'll see that you can actually track yourself the movement of your account. So you can see exactly who signed on, where, from what location, based on the IP number, the identifying mark that you have every time you connect with the Internet. It doesn't actually give you the specific street address and take you to that person's house and tell you what their criminal record is, but it gets you a part of the way there.
What do you think that your son and his 400 friends and their 400 friends may have learned from this experience?
Well, number one, easy lesson, obvious lesson, is back up your files. My son lost most particularly one of the most cherished documents in my life, which is my son's list that he's kept since he was a little kid of every movie he's ever seen and his rankings of them.
Do you think your son will also think twice before posting something, I don't know, private, potentially incriminating about himself?
You know, that's a really interesting thing. He took great pride in having walled off his Facebook page so that only he and his friends could see their conversations. And the shock of seeing this photograph of this stranger just appearing on his wall, that was really the most emotionally difficult moment of the whole experience for him, because his concept of what constitutes privacy in this quickly evolving online world was shattered in that moment.
Mark Fisher is the enterprise editor for local news at The Washington Post. He joined us from their offices in D.C. Thanks a lot, Mark. Good luck. Let us know what happens.
I will. Thanks so much, Leah.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. No one in the tech industry is neutral about controversial network neutrality rules that are set for a vote at the Federal Communications Commission on Tuesday. The FCC's chairman says the rules would protect the free and open Internet, but public interest groups and tech companies say net neutrality favors the giant phone and cable companies that provide broadband access to millions of Americans. Joel Rose has more.
This past Wednesday, more than 1,500 cupcakes, the fancy kind that cost almost $30 a dozen, arrived at the FCC in Washington. The gift came courtesy of AT&T, the giant phone and broadband company the commission is charged with regulating.
There was a lot of laughing and joking about it, but you know, AT&T has been making numerous visits to the FCC chairman's office.
Gigi Sohn is president of Public Knowledge, the nonprofit group that publicized the cupcake contribution in a blog post last week. In its own blog post, AT&T said the cupcake delivery to the FCC is an annual tradition. An FCC spokesperson downplayed its significance, saying the commission is both pro-open Internet and pro-cupcake. But Gigi Sohn isn't laughing. She says the open Internet rules the FCC is set to vote on were shaped by the phone and cable companies that spend millions of dollars a year lobbying the agency and Congress.
A lot of the language that's being debated now was actually written by AT&T lobbyists. And those sections are the ones that the chairman has been most unwilling to change.
AT&T declined to be interviewed for this story, but it's no secret that the big phone, cable, and tech companies have been meeting all year with the FCC and members of Congress to craft new rules of the road for the internet. On one side are such companies as Amazon, Netflix, and Skype that want broadband providers to treat all of the traffic on their networks equally, an idea known as net neutrality. On the other side are those broadband providers.
In an ideal world for them, there would be no oversight whatsoever.
Rebecca Arbogast is an analyst at Stifel Nicolaus.
The cable industry has come out and said, you know, although we'd rather not have net neutrality rules at all, these are rules that we can live with. AT&T came out with a similar statement.
There are a couple of reasons for that tentative support. First, the rules would allow broadband providers to charge companies like Netflix extra fees to get products to their customers faster. And second, broadband providers would be free to slow down or block some applications on their wireless networks in the name of managing traffic. Josh Silver, president of the public interest group Free Press, says those are dangerous loopholes.
If we allow toll roads to go up on the internet in a new way where these companies control your experience, the internet will never be the same.
Last week, Free Press and other net neutrality backers met with FCC Commissioner Michael Copps and urged him not to approve the proposed rules without major changes. The two Republicans on the commission have already said they'll vote no because they're opposed to new broadband regulations. That makes Copps' vote crucial to passing the chairman's open internet rules.
There are times in life when maybe nothing is better than something. Would I be prepared to vote no here if this is an item that's unacceptable or does more harm than good? Yes, I am.
Copps says he will only vote for the rules with some key changes, including stronger consumer protections for wireless and stricter limits on so-called fast lanes.
In the final analysis, this is all about who's going to control the experience of consumers when they go online. Up until now, we've tried to make sure that it was the consumers who were doing that rather than companies.
Copps says it's not too late for FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski to get his vote. But Gigi Sohn at Public Knowledge says Genachowski, who declined our request for an interview, may be forced to do something he's avoided all year, break with the broadband industry.
Chairman Genachowski is under the misguided notion that if he keeps AT&T in the tent, that somehow that will tamp down Republicans in Congress when they take over the House of Representatives in January.
Indeed, the FCC hasn't even voted on the rules, and the political attacks have already begun. Last week, Senate Republicans attached an amendment to the omnibus spending bill that would block the FCC from enforcing net neutrality. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.